This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycast.
There is a queer angle to every issue, and we will find it. Don't expect us to be nice. Don't expect it to be safe. And don't expect us to be politically correct. Nothing is sacred. We find the queer, profane, and cringeworthy wherever we can, here on Joy 94.9. Is nothing sacred?
Hi there, Joysters. This is Jim here, and you're on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. And we have got a very crowded studio tonight, because not only am I here, but we've got the regular team. So there's James. Hello, James.
Hello.
And Steph. Hello, Steph.
Hello, Jim.
And Claire, who's becoming a regular on our team.
Hey, Jim. How are you?
And we have our regular monthly guest, Clovis Palmer from the Burnett Institute, who is going to talk about something, amongst other things, which is probably apposite after that little show from the girls on the wet spot tonight, where they were talking about anal sex. Are we allowed to say that on there? Anal sex.
It's after 10 o'clock. We can say anal what we sex. Like.
We can and say so, what we like.
Clovis, I do believe that you're going to talk a bit about leaky gut syndrome, aren't you?
Yep.
You might want to listen, girls.
It's a bit luby in here, isn't it?
And, well, you know, you're not sliding off the chair yet, are you?
Close to.
So we've got a big, big show tonight. So welcome, Clovis.
And thanks for having me.
Also in the studio we have Paul Kidd, who is the chair of the HIV Legal Working Group for Living Positive Victoria, who and the AIDS Council, who I believe was really instrumental in the reform of the law to repeal Section 19A of the Criminal Code, which criminalised HIV, gay men with people with HIV in Victoria, in a way that was sort of unique in the world. And Paul's going to come on later and talk to us about that and what the implications and ramifications are with that repeal. So that's going to be an interesting bit. So, oh, and happy birthday, Claire, because it's Claire's birthday. She's 21 again today.
Thanks, Jim. Times two in a bit.
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay, well, Clovis, let's go.
Okay, where do you want to start?
Well, where do you want to start? It's your bit.
Well, first of all, the question is, what is leaky gut syndrome? So we know that during HIV infection, during the early period, you know, a few days to a week after infection, you have what you call the leaky gut. And basically what happens is that the virus you know, destroy CD4 cells, immune cells in the gut, and then your gut pretty much becomes leaky. So what happens is that you have these bacterial endotoxin, bacterial byproducts that can traverse through your gut into your bloodstream, and that can wreak havoc to your immune system. And that is what actually drives immune inflammation, which drives CD4 cell loss or immune cell deterioration in HIV-infected persons.
So is this something that a person would be aware of when it's happening, or is something
Absolutely not. In fact, it's only a few years ago this syndrome has been described.
And so it's an internal leakage, isn't it?
So it's internal. So basically you have the gut being compromised, you have the bacterial endotoxin or substances, and even the bacteria themselves can traverse the gut lining.
Clovis, by gut you mean intestinal?
Yeah, intestine. Yeah.
Just clarifying.
Yeah. And so what happened is that these, even in, you know, co-infection, for example, this is why people with co-infection with hepatitis C, for example, have increased liver injury due to this endotoxin leakage in the gut that goes straight to the liver.
So people with any compromised internal organ problem would have potentially a big problem at the point of serotransmission.
Seroconversion, yeah. And especially if you're overweight as well. So we know that overweight individuals have a leaky gut as well, and that is as a result of the sort of differences in symbiosis. So that means when you are overweight or you are HIV infected, the different strains of bacteria in your gut that changes.
Well, that puts a different complexion on being fat and fabulous, doesn't it?
Clovis, does that mean that other organs like the pancreas, for example, could be involved, or perhaps even, you know, lungs or other organs that we wouldn't think wouldn't ordinarily be involved in a syndrome like that?
Well, it's predominantly the gut, the intestine, but whatever affects the gut naturally going to affect the different organs of the digestive system. Mm. And so the question is, how do we combat this inflammation induced by the leaky gut? And there have been several studies. One remarkable study by a guy called Jason Bransley. He's a colleague of mine, actually. And that was published recently, or a couple of years ago, in the Journal of Clinical Investigation. And what they found was that in monkey models, when they gave these monkey who were infected with HIV, probiotics, they significantly improve the inflammation in these animals. And in fact, it helped to improve the CD4 count as well.
So does that mean we can then jump to a conclusion that would be helpful in people as well? So those probiotic drinks and things we see on TV, they actually work?
Except that they're full of sugar.
This should work. And in fact, there have been several studies that have shown that certain probiotics do have important results, significant results in people living with HIV. This important thing is what type of probiotics should we use and the strains of bacteria. And that's where the fine line is drawn.
And there are millions of them, aren't there?
Yeah, there are millions of them, but there are specific bacteria done in these research that have shown significantly to improve the immune system in people living with HIV.
Well, I did notice that there was an advert on TV the other night for one of these new probiotic pills, which doesn't need refrigeration, which said there were something like X billion per capsule that you were taking. So how do you know which of the billion of them do you need to take?
Well, there's some specific bacterial colonies. One of them is called Lactobacillus rufimus, and that specific bacteria seems to be one of the key ingredients in these probiotics that actually have significant results in people living with HIV. So it's not a matter of just going and take any probiotics. You should have specific probiotics. The question is, how do you regulate it so that you don't have contamination, and you don't want to give people who are already compromised immune system something that is, you know, contaminated.
Well, I think it seems to me that it raises all the same problems that that any health claim that food can make. I mean, I've got no problem with people claiming benefit from food. You know, all these margarine people that go, oh, if you take our margarine, you'll lower your risk of heart disease, etc., etc. That's fine with me, as long as they can demonstrate it by some good clinical research. Then yeah, they should be allowed to say it. But if they can't prove it, then they shouldn't be allowed to say it. So it would mean that that we'd have to expect to see fairly soon some approaches by the manufacturers of some of these probiotics coming along and saying, we will fund this clinical research to do this, and then they raise a whole lot of other ethical problems.
Yeah, and there have been clinical research. There have at least been four over the past two or three years. And all of them, some of them published in good reputable Journal of New England, Journal of Medicine. And it clearly shows that there are beneficial effects of probiotics.
Is there regulation in the probiotic industry that's well documented, Clovis?
Not very regulated, so that's the issue. So how do you tell whether or not you actually getting the correct bacteria mix? And it's just not about
and the right dose. How do you regulate the dose?
Yep, exactly.
So it's the same as anything in terms of complementary therapies, isn't it? It's regulating the dose, making sure that it's right and that it's a consistent dose.
Is there a risk in having too much probiotics? Is that something that is bad?
well, too much of anything is bad, really.
Too much of a good thing.
But the evidence is clear that these probiotics do work. And the question is, we don't have anything to treat inflammation associated with HIV at the moment. And inflammation is one of the driver for these comorbidities that people have. So the question is, why aren't we not exploring these alternative areas until the so-called pill?
Would there be another more standardized protocol that medical practitioners would be using for leaky gut at the moment?
No, unfortunately, there's absolutely nothing.
Do most medical practitioners not know about leaky gut or don't see it as an issue?
It's not treated.
We can't treat it. That's a question. That's the most important thing. We know about it, but we can't treat it. And it's one of the areas that a lot of studies have been done. Recently, there was a clinical trial with Savalimir, and what that does is to try to stop the bacterial endotoxin from entering into the system. And that worked incredibly well in monkey models. But when we went on to look at it in human being, I mean, the results were very disappointing. So it's something that is acknowledged in the field. It's something that we have to tackle. But at the moment, there's absolutely nothing we can do.
Sounds almost like a form of poisoning through the gut that's treatable but yet not adequately researched.
Yep, exactly.
Well, I think we're going to go on being able to talk about this forever, but we're going to have to take a little break now and have some messages from our sponsors and so on.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
So we are talking with Dr. Clovis Palmer from the Burnett Institute, our resident HIV specialist, and we had a request from within the studio for me to ask you about fecal transplants. So now, unfortunately, I have to follow the requests as requested. So earlier before the song, we were talking about leaky gut syndrome, which is something that happens when people first get infected with HIV that is just being
understood.
Which doesn't
mean you've got diarrhea.
No, it's an internal leakage. I didn't know that until just then, today.
You could end up with a diarrhea, though.
You could end up with a diarrhea, lots
yeah,
of
you
things.
Can, you could.
Very good pun. So I just have to ask the question. So is this something that happens? Is this something that's useful, fecal transplants?
Yes, I knew this would come up. So it's something that I've been discussed in the scientific literature for a while, actually. And basically what it is that you get these feces from healthy individuals, and then you put it in capsule, and you give it to people who could benefit.
Capsules, to take orally?
To take orally.
What? Yeah.
Because
what? I thought it went up the other end.
No. But it's in a plastic
that's
thing.
That's so much grosser than I thought.
The issue
you're
is
not going to taste anything. You're just going to taste the wax capsule. It's just like taking
a
codrol or something.
And it's purified.
Like
it's purified. How they purify it, I'm not completely sure. But the essence behind it is that some of these very good bacteria, we can't grow them properly in the petri dish. So they have to be grown naturally in the natural environment. So which is naturally the intestine where the feces is.
So do people, how do you get these healthy people? Are they looking for like blood donors, sperm donors, poo donors? Is like where, or are they usually like family members or
no, so,
who are they?
So any healthy young individuals who have a normal bacterial flora.
So would the hospital do a call out? I'm just curious about that process of how people volunteer or
so at the moment
do they know each other?
It's experimental, so I don't think you'll be able to go and over the counter and buy poo at the moment. But it's something that I've shown efficacy, and
I've seen some reports of it overseas where doctors are actually using it as a treatment. But I don't know how they get hold of it.
Yeah, it's not something that is on the mainstream.
It's certainly not approved of, is it, by most of the medical profession yet?
No, the question is how do you purify the bad bacteria from the good bacteria? Because sometimes even if you appear to be healthy, you could have, some disease.
So I did actually hear about this once a couple of years ago when one of my friends was having gut problems. And we got into a big discussion about what kind of feces you'd prefer. Like, do you want a friend? Do you want a vegetarian person? Whatever. So if you're listening at home, have an opinion on this, please SMS on 0427JOY949.
Or even better, email us on air at joy.org.au.
And tell us how you feel about fecal transplants. And if you had to have one, who you would choose.
And no, actually, even better, ring Hannah on the front desk and tell her, hi there, Hannah. You'll be prepared to get a phone call about poo.
We might be hearing from the wet spot again.
I think we've heard from the wet spot.
Quite enough tonight, perhaps,
yeah. So Clovis, tell us
more. So you can have your fecal transplant where you actually can go up the rear end, or you can have the capsule if you so want to, swallow it.
Well, at least there are options, aren't there?
There are options. And as I said, I perhaps would rather get in it from a vegetarian.
Mean that all those people are into scat potentially healthier than the rest of us?
They seem to have a better bacterial flora going on. Vegetarians, yeah.
Oh, our guest is cringing in the corner of the room at the moment. One of our guests cringing in the corner of the room at the moment. It's the first time I've ever seen Paul Kidd cringe. Everybody out there that knows Paul Kidd, he's cringing.
I was just thinking there's something like from a psychological perspective that thinking about someone eating an animal and then that going through a person out the back and then into someone new somehow seems more gross.
Well, it might be a healthier way of processing.
Yeah, but somehow more gross than just, like vegetables. It's like how kangaroo poo is less gross than dog poo.
Just be done with it and eat dirt.
That's what we did when we were kids.
But it's a similar way of water purification. There's, thinking that you could, purify your latrine water and we drink it and it's perfectly healthy. So if you can find ways to, purify the poo to get the good bacteria out of it, then that's
fine.
So
would this mean that one of the ways of doing this would be to do it on a population basis by using recycled sewage and pushing the recycled sewage into the main water supply, making sure we didn't kill off the good bugs and just letting everybody get a healthy glass of water every morning?
Let's call it an infusion. Beautiful.
I can hear the vaccination people now. Anyway, so what else is new? What's this big new grant you just got, Clovis? I saw the other day that it was announced that you and
Suzanne Crowe and Jenny Hoy
got a new grant.
Yeah, so it's a grant from Merck, and we were very happy we were successful. And it's a study frailty in the Australian population. So we all know that people with HIV, they tend to age quicker than the normal population. And they have, symptoms of frailty and comorbidities. So the question is, We want to ask the question whether or not there's a high prevalence in our population and whether or not the drugs that they are taking or have taken is one of the problems for frailty. So we currently enrolling people in our studies.
How are you enrolling?
So it's again we looking at the age population. So predominantly men, because the majority of people living with HIV in Australia are men.
You enrolling through GPs or?
Yes, through the Alfred Hospital. So because we need to have their clinical records and history. So it's much easier if they have already been enrolled through the or attending clinics through the hospital.
Do you have any hypotheses, or are you game to say that, whether you think that this effect is something to do with the impact of the virus or the impact of the medication or something else?
Yeah, so for sure, we think that the virus has a role, but again, we've seen this in people on therapy who have effectively control the virus. So this means that inflammation is a key part of this phenomenon. We also think that, that the past treatments that people have been on, so the protease inhibitors pre 2005, for example, or even pre 1995.
Oh yeah, they were rough.
Yep. So whether or not there's still the long lasting effects, so they are not on those drugs anymore, but are they still seeing the effects of those drugs?
Sorry, Clive, is that AZT and all of those category? Or?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. So you'll have people who were on AZT, for example, you know, 3-5 years, and then go on to the more lipid friendly drugs. The question is, did AZT did a heck of a terrible job that period of time.
And also, I mean, everybody that took AZT in the early days were actually overdosed, weren't they, really?
Yep.
When you think about it in terms of today's dosage.
It certainly was preferable to what was before that, which was nothing. But
it was preferable to death, really.
Yeah. But we've come a long way by the sounds of it. It's really fascinating stuff. Look, thanks for all of those insights, Clive. It's really interesting.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
I'm really excited because we have a message in from Hannah in Seddon. And poor Hannah, she's a vegetarian. And after we had to talk about poo, she's going, truly though, science is absolutely incredible. As a vegetarian, I think I'd only be keen on vegetarian poo, in case you were wondering. No, we weren't actually wondering, Hannah, but
I was wondering. I did ask people about their preferences for poo donors. We have been talking to Dr. Clovis Palmer about fecal transplants and benefit for gut bacteria, but we now have a new guest who has explicitly said he will not talk about poo. So, Jim, you'd better ask me about something else.
Okay, then, I will. We've got in the studio with us tonight Paul Kidd, who is the chair of the legal working group of Living Positive Victoria and the AIDS Council. And Paul did a whole lot of work last year to lobby for the decriminalisation of Section 19A of the Victorian Criminal Code. And during the International AIDS Conference, we all marched up and down Flinders Street with our big banners that said repeal. In fact, I even wore a T-shirt that said repeal 19A, if I remember rightly. It's on my Facebook page somewhere. So welcome, Paul.
Hey.
Give us a big update.
Yeah, okay. So it's actually been a bit more than a year that we have been working on this. Been working on this really intensively for about 4 years now to try and move forward a whole suite of things around criminalisation of HIV, which we've identified as one of the issues we want to address here in Victoria. And then last year we focused particularly on this one issue of repealing Section 19A.
What did it do?
Well, Section 19A is a law that's on the books here in Victoria. It's been there since 1993, and it specifically deals with the intentional transmission of HIV. So it deals with a situation in which someone tries to give another person HIV.
And it's never been used, has it, as a law?
It's been used a few times. It's never really been used successfully. No one's ever been convicted of intentionally transmitting HIV in Victoria. But the problem with this law is that it sits there and it sends a message about people with HIV which we think is really unhelpful, and it's certainly not true. It says that people with HIV are a danger to the community. It says that we're a threat, and that's not only is that, you know, first of all, it's just a lie. People with HIV on the whole are the leaders in HIV prevention. We're the people who are out there trying to prevent other people from getting HIV. But it also has a really powerful stigmatising effect. You know, that message that goes out there, and when people are prosecuted for HIV-related crimes, the way the media report those crimes is incredibly stigmatising.
It does not encourage anybody who might think that they've been in contact with HIV to test, does it? Because then they're put into all sorts of personal problems in terms of their own, perhaps their own morality and ethics and all that sort of stuff.
I was just going to ask, is this an anomalous law? Like, is this the only law we have in Australia, in the world, where someone can be found guilty of giving someone an illness? Because surely, you know, no one wants to get food poisoning, you know, whatever. No one wants to get a cold. Is this the only place where it exists?
Certainly, An important thing about the repeal of Section 19A is that we're not saying that the intentional transmission of HIV shouldn't be against the law. We certainly think it should be.
And in fact, that's
one thing that we think, you know, absolutely should be against the law. You know, adding to that the fact that, you know, that's an extremely rare situation where that happens. But there are laws on the books about hurting other people, about doing violence to other people already. You don't need a special law just for HIV. And Victoria is the only state in Australia that has a HIV-specific criminal law. We're certainly not the only place in the world that has one. There are lots of other places that have one, and criminalisation of HIV is a big issue all around the world, not just here.
The whole concept of intent, too, is dubious. How do you get into someone's bedroom and actually show that they intentionally transmitted HIV? How could that be proven?
Look, it's a high bar, because you are actually asking, you know, legally intent is about getting inside the mind of the offender and understanding what that person's state of mind was at the time they did the thing.
But it was anomalous, wasn't it, when it was introduced in 1993? I remember when the introduction was, and we were having the big argument then about whether you needed to disclose to all your sexual partners, and we actually defeated the proposals in Victoria to have disclosure, though they didn't in New South Wales.
That's right. Yes, absolutely. There were some cases around that time. There was a case where someone was stabbed with a blood fill syringe, and there was a bit of a spate of hold ups and armed robberies where people used blood fill syringes. Now, the thing about that is that none of those people were HIV positive. No HIV positive person has ever in Australia done a, you know, armed robbery with a blood filled syringe. It just hasn't happened. But that's the law that was passed because, you know, the argument was it was 1993. Remember, the treatments for HIV were very much in their infancy. Everybody who was diagnosed with HIV was expected to die. So it was kind of like characterised as it's this kind of slow murder. We need a special law to deal with it. You know, the reality is we never needed that law, and we certainly don't need it now.
And probably another risk associated with it would be that it could be used for vilification. It could be used by groups of people to vilify another person. That's a more serious aspect of it, isn't it? That it could be used negatively against another person in a sort of a gang up or, you know. That's sort of an approach.
Look, that's absolutely right. As I say, it has that stigmatising effect. I think that people sometimes they may discover that the person they've had sex with is HIV positive. They feel like they've been cheated, that they've been lied to because the person didn't disclose their HIV status. And we've certainly seen cases where even where condoms are used, people go off to the police and complain about people. And occasionally, you know, people do get criminalised through this process. We think that's a really, you know, from the public health perspective, it's a really unhelpful process. We also know that the police use this law as a kind of, you know, bargaining chip where people are accused of lesser crimes. The existence of Section 19A, you know, it acts as a kind of a lever that the police can pull in various situations.
So was there much of a fight with the then opposition, the now government, to bring this into the platform, and did you have to fight hard for them to keep that election promise?
I think we use the conference really effectively to highlight this as one of a range of issues that we wanted to highlight, but we got a lot of mileage out of this issue, partly because it is a global issue, and it's a hot global issue. It's something that activists around the world are working on, and there hasn't been a lot of progress. There's been a lot of backward progress in this area. So we were able to highlight our situation here. We wanted to embarrass the government. We think it is an embarrassment that we have this law, and I think we were effective in doing that, and we got commitments
from
both
sides. And in fact, there's a podcast of our show during the AIDS conference with Matt McCoy from Iowa and who was our other guest? The guy that had been recently released from prison in Iowa.
Nick Rhodes.
Nick Rhodes. And that podcast is up on our Facebook page and on the Joy website, if anybody would like to go back and hear that, which was really an interesting discussion about criminalisation.
We are going to continue talking with Paul. If you have any questions, you can SMS on 0427 JOY 949. That's 0427 569 949. Email on air at joy.org.au. It's 17 minutes to 11.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
That wasn't Justin. Was that really Justin
That was
Bieber?
Justin Bieber. It was even more boring than Gloria Estefan.
I thought it was system. More fun than that. Like, you know, like Hanson, no. But younger.
No, it wasn't like Hanson at all. He thinks he's Marky Mark now, of course.
Mm. He's moved on from that, Steph.
I'm clearly behind the times.
Okay, we in the studio, we've been talking about the repeal of Section 19A of the Victorian Criminal Code with Paul Kidd, who's chair of the HIV Legal Working Group of Living Positive Victoria and the Victorian AIDS Council. And in the Parliament at the moment is the repeal bill, which we hope is going to become an Act of Parliament. Where are we up to, Paul? Do we have to fight crossbench thing in the Legislative Council? And have the Liberals moved on from the days of Geoff Kennett and Marie Tehan?
That's a good question. This is a law that was passed by the Kennett government. At the moment, the bill is in the lower house of Parliament. The Labor Party, it's a Labor government bill, and so the Labor Party will support it. So it'll go through the lower house, no problem there. Labor doesn't have a majority in the upper house, so we need some other votes to come and support our bill to make that happen.
Well, there are a few crossbenchers that we can probably rely on, aren't there? I mean, Fiona Patten from the Sex Party, the Greens, yep. Perhaps.
The Greens and the Sex Party 100% on board, so we're absolutely guaranteed of their votes. We really want to see, though, a bipartisan support for this bill. You know, Australia's got a tremendous record, going back to the early days of HIV, of bipartisan support for doing the right thing around HIV, whether it's about needle and syringe programs, whether it's about decriminalising sex work, whether it's about repealing the sodomy laws. We think that's the right way to do the laws around these things. So we're really hoping that the coalition parties will come on board and will support this bill. We've certainly been talking to them. They haven't made that decision yet, but we are really hopeful that we will see a bipartisan support for this bill, and it'll go through with a really positive debate that affirms the importance of a health-based response to a health issue.
So in the second reading of the bill in the Parliament, when a number of the speeches can occur, has that second reading debate occurred yet?
No, it hasn't. So that is scheduled to happen next Tuesday, the 5th of May. So it's on the notice paper for the next sitting day of Parliament.
And people can go to Parliament and sit in the public gallery and watch, can't they?
They sure can. I'll be there.
In the State Parliament or the Federal Parliament?
Yeah, the State Parliament in Spring Street.
State Parliament. Check it out. I've been. It's pretty fun. If you're a politics nerd.
Like a school excursion or something.
No, I briefly worked with Victorian Parliament. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
So and what's the next thing?
As I said at the outset, you know, repealing Section 19A is important. It's really powerful, symbolic aspect of what we're doing. But what we want to see in the longer term is a reduction in the number of people being prosecuted for HIV altogether. So we're also pushing for the adoption of a set of prosecutorial guidelines by the Director of Public Prosecutions. So that's very much on our agenda to try and rationalise the way the law works and ensure that wherever possible, people are dealt with through the health system, not through the criminal justice system.
Which has pretty much been the case on a lot of the laws, the public health laws in Victoria, hasn't it? We have the HIV panel in the health department, which deals with recalcitrants and so on.
We have in Victoria a really good model, I think, where there is a lot of power that's put in the hands of the chief health officer to control not just HIV but all kinds of public health issues. But we also have this panel that's been established. There's community representation on that panel. There are experts on that panel, and they provide advice to ensure that the chief health officer has the right advice to make the right decisions. I think that might be something you brought in your time in the department, Jim.
Thank you, Jim.
And from a research perspective, like, because I assume like the overall goal of all this is reducing new people being exposed to HIV. And my understanding is that having a public health approach where it's open and discussed and people feel safe and that they're not going to be prosecuted against is actually a good thing for public health as well as from an individual human rights
perspective. And it's not just for HIV that this is important, it's for other infectious diseases. And we've seen Victoria have quite a good response to things like avian flu and swine flu, tuberculosis. You know, we've got a good tuberculosis model here, and there are things like when we had a polio outbreak from students from Pakistan, we were able to deal with that quite successfully, and we used basically the same model.
If you think about it in contrast to the hepatitis A berry scandal, it's quite stark, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think that one of the real strengths of the public health case management approach is that it's about the future. It's not about the past. It's not about punishing people for what they've done in the past. It acknowledges that people sometimes make mistakes. They sometimes do the wrong thing. They sometimes do very foolish and very inappropriate things. But the focus is on enabling those people to change and to give them the information, give them the support, give them the assistance, and, you know, and to give them the coercion sometimes that they need to change their ways. And that enables people to continue to be productive members of society. It enables people to continue going on with their lives.
And to continue placing the emphasis on public health.
That's exactly right. Because, you know, at the end of the day, HIV is a virus. You know, it's not a weapon. It's not a crime. It's not something that you can pass a law against. It's something that's out there in the community, and we all need to be partners in dealing with it. And I think the public health approach is the way to get that to happen.
Well, I think we'd agree with that, and we've had many a show here where we've talked about the public health approach to HIV, and I think, you know, we're likely to have many more of them in future.
We'll keep telling people until they all believe us.
And, you know, we'll have an interesting discussion fairly soon with Clovis, I think, in one of our next lot of his returns around PrEP and PEP and all that sort of stuff. So we are going to go to some more messages now. Are we going to go? Oh, actually, look at the time, everybody.
It's 5 minutes
five
to 11.
5 minutes to 11.
Where's it gone?
Thank you, Clovis, for coming in. And thank you, Paul Kidd, for coming in.
Thanks, guys.
Because, as people might not know, but Paul Kidd's a country bumpkin and lives about an hour or so away from Melbourne. So
that's very dedicated for 4 minutes to 11 on a Monday night.
It is very, very good. So we're happy that
we're patting him on the back.
We've got one of the heroes in the studio. We're all heroes in the studio. Thank you, Steph. Thank you, Claire. I hope you're settling in now, are you?
I am. I flew all the way from Brisbane to be here tonight.
And happy birthday.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, James, for
thanks,
all your
guys.
Technical work.
And we will be back next week with more exciting guests. And Clovis will be back next month as our regular expert. And you are on Joy 94.9. See you, hear you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.